evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Abiyaz Karim, and Jaya Kumar. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At their last meeting, Council unanimously voted to declare food insecurity an emergency in the Kingston region. Food insecurity is defined as the inadequate or insecure access to food due to financial constraints, categorized from marginal to severe. Dr. Elaine Power, a Queen's University professor, spoke before council, emphasizing that numbers have hit historic highs.
I actually have to go back and look at this every time I do a presentation because I can hardly believe the numbers. These are from 2023, where we have 23% of Canadians across the country, not the territories, living in food insecure households. And that's likely an underestimate. 20 years ago, we had 4 million Canadians who were food insecure, and we're now approaching 9 million. It's probably over 9 million, including over 2 million children. One in four children in this country living in food insecure households. We have almost 25% of Ontarians, and Kingston Public Health estimates one in three households in this city are food insecure.
Dr. Power and the motion itself listed various health impacts associated with food insecurity, including higher rates of numerous diseases and chronic health conditions and a higher risk of early death. Dan Irwin, Executive Director of Partners in Mission Food Bank, also shared startling numbers in a presentation before council.
We are not solving food insecurity with a food bank. What we're doing is addressing hunger, and it's a very temporary situation. In 2024, Partners in Mission Food Bank experienced its fourth record year in a row. We distributed 20,355 food hampers, which is 10.2% more than last year, to 9,131 people, including more than 2,800 kids. This equals to 1 in 17. In 2023, that was 1 in 19.
Partners in Mission Food Bank is also currently in the process of moving into a larger space after outgrowing its space of 23 years. Councillor Don Amos asked Irwin about the future of Partners in Mission as demand continues to rise.
How many more times can you sustain a 10% growth?
Excellent question. But you are right. If I was running a real business that was trying to make money, we'd be laughing at the growth we've got. And it is shocking. We can only do what we can with the help of our community. I'm very concerned that at some point we're going to hit a wall and we're going to be helping so many people that we won't have enough to help. So that's the wall. I don't know. I can't tell you when it's coming. I just know it is.
While the city has made efforts to address the crisis through funding local hunger-fighting organizations and initiatives like the Fines for Food pilot program, councillors expressed that the city has reached their limit. Councillor Brandon Tozo brought forward the advocacy-based motion.
We're doing all we can as a city to address food insecurity, and it's not enough. It's an emergency.
The motion requests action from higher levels of government, ranging from requesting an immediate increase in funding to school food programs and raising social assistance rates, to considering larger solutions like establishing a guaranteed livable basic income. The motion also requests that the provincial and federal governments include the reduction of food insecurity in all appropriate government policies, and that all political parties address food insecurity in their party platforms. Councillor Gregory Ridge summed up the purpose of the motion.
I've had people ask me, what is this going to do? Why is declaring an emergency going to do? And I understand those concerns. We've declared emergencies on several things, several very, very important items. But I consider this emergency, declaring this an emergency to all these levels of government, seeking cooperation for all these levels of government. It's like a motion. It's a signal. It's a Hail Mary. It's like when you come home at the end of a long, long day and you sit in bed and you pray to God or the universe or whatever you believe in and say, please, please let tomorrow be better. And that's what people are feeling in this community right now. So I hope people support this motion. Let's do what we can to make tomorrow better.
A copy of the motion has been sent to the Prime Minister, party leaders, and other elected officials, as well as various organizations, including the Association of Municipalities of Ontario. In a message directly from the City of Kingston, share your knowledge of local history at Heritage Hour. Share your expertise and deepen the community's understanding of the city's diverse heritage by applying to speak at Heritage Hour. The City of Kingston is seeking knowledgeable speakers with unique insights into Kingston's many histories, cultures, and traditions for the quarterly speaker series. Melanie Banks, manager of Heritage Programming, states, quote, "We're excited to expand Heritage Hour speaking opportunities through an open application to include even more community voices. The previous speakers have showcased many facets of Kingston's history, and we look forward to creating space for more stories to be shared," end quote. Selected speakers will have 1 hour to present to an engaged audience on topics that highlight Kingston's physical and living heritage. Speakers are invited to share information in a variety of formats, including lectures, workshops, and interactive presentations. Since 2023, Heritage Hour has featured speakers from across the community to speak about Kingston's diverse heritage resources. A playlist of previous Heritage Hour events can be found on the City of Kingston YouTube channel. You can view the application and program details on Get Involved Kingston. In another message from the City of Kingston, connect the past to the future. Join the city's Arts, Culture, and Heritage Advisory Committee. From art to artifacts, help us tell our community's story. Apply to join the City of Kingston's newly created Arts, Culture, and Heritage Advisory Committee. Up to 8 members of the public, including one youth representative aged 15 to 24, will help guide the city's arts, culture, and heritage strategies, policies, and programs, providing information and advice to city staff and council. The committee will meet up to 6 times a year. This group will also serve as the advisory committee for the city's museums, providing suggestions and feedback about cultural heritage programs and exhibits at the 2 city-owned museums, Kingston City Hall National Historic Site and the Market Wing Cultural Space. Additionally, the committee will help guide the maintenance and development of the Civic Artifact Collection. This is an ideal opportunity for people with experience in arts and culture, artistic organizations, local history and heritage, museums, and heritage preservation and cultural tourism. Applicants must be residents or business owners in Kingston, and Canadian citizens or permanent residents who have lived in Kingston for at least 1 year. Learn more about the committee's mandate and apply online at cityofkingston.ca/committees from January 13th to 31st, 2024. Those who wish to apply in person can also do so at City Hall. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jaya and Abiyaz with Campus Corner, the latest in Queen's campus news.
Thank you. In campus news, a reminder that the AMS elections and referenda are just around the corner. The nomination period for the AMS executive election, the rector election, and referendum groups seeking new, continuing, or increased student fees will run from January 13th to January 16th. Don't forget, the ratification assembly is scheduled for January 20th at 6 p.m. For more information on the campaign period, visit the AMS website. The Queen's Departmental Student Councils are also preparing for their upcoming elections. Students interested in running for Departmental Student Council co-president are invited to attend an informational session on Wednesday, January 22nd at 6 p.m. in the Kingston Hall Reflection Room. The session will provide details about the election process and the roles of Departmental Student Councils on campus. In other Departmental Student Council news, the Queen's University History Departmental Student Council is also preparing for their Resistance and Regrowth Conference on January 16th. This event will bring together undergraduates in the humanities and social sciences for an evening of learning and collaboration. Tickets are $12 and can be purchased now via the History Departmental Student Council Instagram page. In other campus news, the Queen's New Generation Annual Conference will take place on January 25th and 26th at the Biosciences Complex. This event explores neuroscience, offering workshops, discussions, and networking opportunities. This year's theme is psychoneuroimmunology, and participants can compete in a case competition with top abstracts being published. Tickets can be purchased now via the New Generation Instagram page. The Queen's Center for International Defense and Policy will be hosting guest speaker Nicole Gillis for the partner event Out of the Shadows to Shine a Light, National Security in 2025 and Beyond. Co-presidented by the Institute of Intergovernmental Relations, the Queen's Center for International Defense and Policy, the Department of Political Studies, and the Queen's International Affairs Association, this event will run at 12 p.m. on January 17th. For more information, visit the Queen's Center for International and Defense Policy website. In other campus news, the AMS Social Issues Commission has opened applications for the Black History and Futures Month grant. This initiative supports projects promoting advocacy, celebration, and inclusivity. The application deadline is January 26th. For more details, visit the AMS Social Issues Commission Instagram page. That's a wrap for this segment of Campus Corner. I'm Jaya Kumar from CFRC News.
Hi folks, I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News. For this segment of Campus Corner, I will be interviewing Ms. Surabhi Velagala. She is running for office in the upcoming SGPS election. Let's get straight to the interview then. So Surabhi, tell us about yourself and what position you are running for.
So currently I'm in my first year of the Master's in Epidemiology program here, where I serve as the 2026 cohort student representative for my program and an events planning executive member for the Student Association and the Joy Committee. Currently for SGPS, the current election, I'm running for the VP graduate position.
Wow. So why are you running for office? I mean, what inspired you to run for this position?
The reason that I'm running is because I really want to ensure a better quality of life for our students through many means and various areas of concern, and make sure that they are adequately supported and informed about the reliable resources that we have. And I also want to make sure that we take collective action towards addressing the needs of our graduate student body. And by collective, I mean taking measures which address these goals by not only being adaptable to modify them while taking the student's body's feedback into consideration. And the main reason is that I've seen and experienced firsthand the challenges that are faced by graduate students, especially through my faculty, which arise, for example, from housing and food insecurity and inadequate financial stability, all while they're still balancing their academic and professional successes and responsibilities. And as graduate students, our academic and professional successes, I believe, should not have to come at the cost of our health or be hindered by any of these concerns like food insecurity and housing. So that's one of the reasons that I'm running for office.
Amazing. So if I may ask, what are the key pillars of your platform?
The key pillars of my platform are, I plan to address four things. So I plan to approach the four key pillars of my campaign while addressing the need for better funding and ensuring fair working conditions. And I know that our needs are dynamic and they depend on the situations that we may need to prioritize differently. So I want to do this by being open to communication and feedback from within our student body, but also staff and organizations which are heavily involved with our graduate students. So the first pillar that I want to address is food insecurity and housing. And I aim to advocate for affordable food, food resources and housing initiatives, and increase the access to reliable food programs by collaborating, maintaining good reputable relationships with organizations within and also outside campus. And I know that we have a lot of good programs in place, but I feel that we can still improve them through advocacy, learning from our environment, and also getting feedback and ideas from students. And secondly, my second pillar is, as someone who works in mental health research, I believe that it's crucial to have adequate resources and support just to maintain good mental and overall health. So for a while, I've read that students are not able to make time for themselves due to the academic pressures and professional pressures that they face, and they apparently don't really know about the resources that we provide. So I really want to make an effort to make students more aware of such resources and workshops and increase their access to them. The third pillar that I want to address is to make efforts towards professional development and academic success so that graduate students can make an efficient transition into the work field or higher studies easier after completing graduate studies. So I aim to do this by enhancing professional development opportunities in various ways, such as like increasing and promoting awareness about scholarships and awards, both internal and external, but also increasing exposure to mentorship and networking opportunities. So through this, I hope that I can make graduate students feel supported and empowered towards their next steps.
Right.
And lastly, I think it's very important to build and maintain strong and meaningful connections with people and build a good community. And as a first-generation immigrant who has the privilege of studying in this diverse and inclusive country, I am committed to promoting and celebrating the diversity of all graduate students, no matter the background, no matter the abilities. And by supporting our existing organizations, such as the QUSC and like other student organizations that we have on campus, while also collaborating with off-campus initiatives, I feel that we can strengthen bonds and we can be a little more culturally sensitive to our peers, allowing us to see things from different lenses.
Awesome. So that brings me to my last question. How can people learn more about you and Volt?
LinkedIn, which just uses my name, Sarabhya Valagala, and my Instagram, SVELA2001, are my main social media and campaigning platforms. So you can read all about my experiences and my campaign a lot more in depth on those platforms. But I also really enjoy communicating with people. So anyone can reach me by email, which can be found on the Elections Candidate Information website on SGPS. Or if you just see me on campus, don't be afraid to say hi and chat. I'm more than happy to answer any kind of questions throughout my campaign. If my campaign resonates with you, to show your support by voting for me during the voting period that goes from January 29th to the 30th, where all SGPS members will receive ballots through Simply Voting.
Thank you, Ms. Surabhi, for your time and best of luck for your campaign. That's a wrap for this segment of Campus Corner. We were in conversation with Ms. Surabhi Valagala, who is running for VP graduate in the upcoming SGPS election. I'm Abhyas from CFRC News. Now over to Isabella for Sports After.
Hello, everybody. I'm Isabella Garrido, your CFRC sports reporter, and welcome to the CFRC Sports Desk, bringing you the latest in Queens athletics. Let's dive right in. This weekend, Queens Distance Track had an incredible showing at the University of Ottawa's Winter Classic, bringing home an impressive 11 medals. Standout performances came from Kaylee Prebas, who secured gold in the 1500 meter and helped the women's relay team earn silver. Jude Wheeler-Dee, who not only took gold in the men's 3,000 meter, but also set a new school record with a time of 8 minutes and 3 seconds. On the women's side, Alicia Alkerton dominated the 3,000 meter, finishing first with 9 minutes and 42 seconds, with teammates Ella Lane and Olivia Bagley completing the podium for a Queens sweep. The men's 400 relay team also shone, grabbing silver in their event, and Gail now prepare for the McGill Team Challenge January 24th to the 26th in Montreal. Shifting gears to hockey, it was a tough weekend for Queens men's hockey team in Montreal, with key players Jack Duff, Nolan Hutchinson, and head coach Brett Gibson representing Canada at the FISU Games. The Gales fell short in back-to-back games against McGill and Concordia, despite a strong start. Goalie Christian Perbeau faced challenges, allowing 10 goals over 2 games. The team looks to bounce back in a heated matchup against the RMC Paladins on January 24th at Constantine Arena. Don't miss it. Tickets are available, or you can stream it live on OUA.tv. Finally, Queens women's volleyball extended their winning streak to an incredible 11 games after a clean sweep of Guelph this weekend. The Gales were led by Hannah Ducheneau with 15 kills and Mary Stewart with 12. The team's defensive efforts were anchored by Holly Biasai, who picked up 11 digs, and their season record now standing at 13-1. The Gales are set to face the Western Mustangs at home on January 31st in what promises to be a thrilling matchup. Tickets are free for us Gales students, so be sure to grab yours and cheer them on at the Arc. This has been Isabella Garrido with your CFRC Sports Desk. Now back to Christina Laurie with your weather report for this evening.
This is the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, January 20th. We are in the midst of a cold snap, daytime high of minus 12, a 40% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping down to a bone-chilling minus 17 overnight. Tuesday, January 21st, we're going to see a daytime high of minus 12, and it's going to be a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to minus 18 overnight. Wednesday, January 22nd, high of minus 10 with a 30% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping down to minus 12 overnight. On Thursday, January 23rd, temperatures increase slightly from the frigid lows of the prior few days. We're going to see a daytime high of minus 6 with a 40% chance of flurries. Moving on to Friday, January 24th, the upward trend for temperature continues. Daytime high of minus 3 with an overnight low of minus 9. Saturday, January 25th, we're going to see a daytime high of -1, so around the zero mark, overnight low of -6. And then Sunday, January 26th, we will see a daytime high of -1 with a 40% chance of flurries. This is Jesse Bell with your City of Kingston traffic report for the week of January 20th, 2025. We begin with some road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Wellington Street, Earl to Gore is closed until January 23rd to accommodate service tie-ins. Here are some other delays you should be aware of. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles and Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes Phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Hello, I'm Henry Walker, CFRC intern from the Queen's Department of History. Here's today's concert and events calendar. Starting with events, coming up on Monday, join the Kingston Climate Change Symposium at the Kingston Grand Theatre, featuring keynote speaker Autumn Peltier. Tickets are available online for $10. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library Central Branch is also hosting a free craft and makerspace session from 6 to 7 p.m. Also on Monday, both One Eye Jacks and the Brass will host their weekly trivia nights starting at 7 and 7:45 respectively. On Tuesday, the Screening Room will be hosting a filmmaker's open mic where local filmmakers can connect with their peers and share their work. The event starts at 6 p.m. and admission is free. The Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Tuesday, the Kingston Frontenac Public Library Central Branch in Yarn GK will be hosting a free crochet and knit circle from 5:30 to 7:30. Also on Tuesday, there will be a public city council meeting at Kingston City Hall starting at 7. Daft Brewing is also hosting a euchre night starting at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, Queen's Musical Theatre will continue their sold-out run of A Sunday in the Park with George, which opened on the 15th at the Tet Center. Doors open at 7 p.m. Performances will continue every day for the rest of the week. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library, Kelvin Park Branch, and L'Association Canadienne Française de l'Ontario will be hosting Café Franglish, starting at 6 p.m., providing a friendly space to practice both your English and French language skills. Also on Wednesday, Musique will be hosting its weekly life drawing event. Bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing and making new friends. Daft Brewing and Something in the Water will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, the Grad Club is running its free weekly trivia night starting at 8 p.m. The Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group has a public run starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Daft Brewing will also be hosting Queerioke starting at 8 p.m. There is a $5 cover at the door. On Thursday, Domino Theater will be continuing their run of The Road to Mecca. Doors open at 7:30 and tickets are available online for $20. Additional performances will occur on the 24th, 25th, and into next week. On Friday, Queen's Career Services will be hosting a workshop focused on equipping participants with essential skills to connect with employers and effectively communicate during networking conversations. The event starts at 11 a.m. in room 324, Gordon Hall, or online. The Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's Swing Dance Club will be running the Zero to Hero Lindy Hop workshop and social in St. George Hall from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Tickets are available for $30. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday morning, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry Walker, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendar. For concerts, coming up on Monday, the Mourning Doves Jazz and Funk Trio will be playing a free show at Musiki till 11, with doors opening at 7. Folks can also head over to the RCHA to see Myers and Flanagan from 4:30 to 6:30 for some early jazz. There's a $5 cover fee for any non-RCHA member. Also Monday, Quirks of Human Nature, an evening of poetry, music, and storytelling will be taking place at the Royal Tavern 2.0 from 7:30 to 9:30. Tuesday evening, head over to the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for another great edition of the weekly Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam, a free event. You can also head down to Musiki for their weekly open mic from 7 to 11 p.m., also free. On Wednesday, take a ride on the Wolf Island Ferry and pop by Open Mic Night with Mike Rapkins at Hotel Wolf Island, a free event starting at 7 p.m. Ale House has three groups for Wednesday night: Carnelian, Chlorine, and Color Theory, booked from 8 to 12. $10 will get you in, with doors opening at 7:30. On Thursday, the Grizzly is featuring Logan Brown's one-person musical comedy act from 8 to 11 p.m. This is a free concert. Hotel Wolf Island is featuring the Brass Over Tea Kettle Brass Band, who will be playing a fusion of pop hits with the sound of the brass bands of New Orleans. This is a free show starting at 8:30 p.m. On Thursday, the RCHA, as part of their Robbie Burns Day celebrations, has both Kingston Group, Turpin's Trail, and the Princess of Wales' own regimental pipe band in for a show starting at 7 p.m., cover charge of $20. On Friday, the band Cabbage will be making their debut performance alongside Brass Over Tea Kettle at the Grad Club. Doors open at 8 p.m. with a $20 cover charge. Toronto-based band The Gettalons will be playing a set at the Toucan, along with the bands Jinx and Color Theory, from 9:30 to 1 a.m. On Friday, Tiernan and Odd will be featuring the Kingston Cosmic Folk group Willy Nilly at a free gate from 9 to 12 p.m. For any Maritime Folk fans, PEI-born Shane Pendergast will be playing from 8:30 to 10 p.m. at a free show at Hotel Wolf Island. And also on Friday, Kingston indie band Cazador will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory at 7. Tickets are available online for $22.60. On Saturday, the group Quartetto Gelato will be performing at the Kingston Grand Theater. The concert starts at 7:30 p.m. and tickets can be found online ranging between $52 to $27, with discounts available for students and children. The Big Fat Horn Band, alongside special guest Deb Feely, will be returning to the RCHA for a show starting at 8 p.m. Tickets are available online for $30. Also on Saturday, folks can head over to the Broom Factory to catch Piner with special guest Princess Towers, two local emerging artists. Doors open at 7 p.m. On Sunday, Danny DeRue will be performing a mix of rock and country at the Caesar Company from 6 to 9 p.m. This is a free event. And finally, the Montreal group Bedouin Soundclash will be performing a concert at the Broom Factory at 8 p.m. Tickets are available online starting at $30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Prefer tea or coffee? Indie, folk, rock, electronic, I've got it all. Tune in to What's Brewing Tuesdays from 7:30 to 8 a.m. for the freshest Canadian music to pair with your morning brew. Listen in as I chat over a cup of something fresh and talk about my favorite new releases from Canadian artists that I love. Nothing like good music and good coffee to start your day, so tune in to see What's Brewing.
Hi, this is Seth Hunt from The Backsteps.
And this is Luke Garrison from The Backsteps. And you're listening to
CFRC
101.9
FM.
Good day. You are listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 249. On the broadcast today, I'm continuing a series of interviews focused on housing justice. These interviews take place in the context of planning and organizing towards a gathering for housing justice that's taking place in Montreal from the 7th to 9th of March 2025 at Concordia University in Montreal. On the series today, I'm going to be featuring an interview with Ryan McCrae, a researcher and organizer at the Cooper Institute in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Ryan speaks and gives voice to the ways that the housing crisis is impacting many communities in Canada, coast to coast to coast. Ryan speaks about how Charlottetown is affected by the realities of things like Airbnb, the removal of rental units, affordable rental units for low-income and working-class people. Ryan is doing organizing in a city that's often not in the headlines, so I thought it was important to highlight his voice in the context of this series of Voices for Housing Justice here on Free City Radio. So here's my conversation with Ryan McCrae of the Cooper Institute in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, here on Free City Radio. The struggle for affordable housing is coast to coast to coast, and that includes the Maritime Region and Prince Edward Island. Often images around the struggle for affordable housing center on Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. Recently, Montreal has, you know, experienced this huge hike in the price of rental units. But that actually has been happening everywhere. And I would imagine that Charlottetown is no different. So Ryan McCrae, you've been working with community organizations in PEI, Prince Edward Island. Can you maybe just introduce yourself and share a bit about why you've been involved in the issue of housing justice and some of the sort of key points that you would like people in different parts of Canada who are involved in this type of work to hear about what you're doing. Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks so much, Stefan, for having me on here. It's wonderful to finally link up. So I've been working with the Cooper Institute for about 3 years. That's a popular education center in Prince Edward Island that does a lot of kind of community work. I worked alongside a former staff person with the Fight for Affordable Housing at Cooper Institute on a joint project between the two organizations. That's when I kind of started getting involved with the Fight for Affordable Housing. What really pushed me, though, was back in 2022, IRAC, the Island Regulatory and Appeals Commission, basically they decide how much the rent can go up each year. So back in 2022, in about November of 2022, the provincial government came out and IRAC said that rent could go up 10.8%. Without any application, really. That's what they deemed was appropriate. This was right after COVID. Tenants were struggling across the country. And, you know, me being a tenant, I was fearful of that, right? So that kind of made me jump. I couldn't believe it. I was astonished. I was in awe that the government would have the audacity, or IRAC, I guess, an arm's length organization of the government, would have the audacity to try to put rent at 10.8%. So, I got involved in kind of speaking at a rally and organizing a rally on that. And that's kind of when I started getting involved with Fight for Affordable Housing, you know. And since then, we've been involved with a lot of different projects. It's been good. I guess some of the big issues, a really big issue that I would like kind of tenant organizers across the country to know, a lot of people fight for vacancy control. PEI is one of two provinces that actually has vacancy control embedded in its tenancy legislation. The problem is, it's us in Manitoba, but the problem is that we don't have a rental registry. And that's been a huge issue. So vacancy control, I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with it, but for those who aren't, means that your rent is tied to the unit, not the tenant. So whenever a tenant moves out and a new tenant comes in, the rent cannot legally be increased. It all has to be, it's tied to that unit. It should stay the same. The problem is in PEI in our province, we see an insane amount of illegal rent increases because when tenants move out, landlords jack up the rent And we have no mechanism or means to kind of verify what the previous tenant paid, something like a rental registry. We've been advocating for this since our inception, back in about 2016, I believe, 2017. You know, that this has been a key thing that the organization has been pushing for, yet there's been no movement. So, you know, it's funny, I hear from, you know, tenant groups across the country pushing for vacancy control, yet here we are, we're a step ahead of them for sure, because we have the legislation, but there's no enforcement mechanism. So without that, we still see, you know, tons of illegal rent increases.
When you mention rental hikes in PEI, you talked about this commission. So this is of the provincial government and Regulatory and Appeals Commission. There's this tension between, you know, activists who are pushing for the idea of non-market housing solutions. So, for example, co-op housing or, you know, different housing models, basically, that are not facing the winds of the market, which you've just described. And, you know, there's so many, like, proposals for technical fixes around this, these sorts of abuses of rental frameworks that we are seeing landlords coast to coast take up and use for profit. There's this tension between, you know, pushing for alternatives and also defending, you know, the situation of tenants today in the current context. And I think probably because PEI is, you know, relatively smaller community, I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about this sort of tension of you supporting tenants, but also trying to push for some of the broader ideas that, you know, housing activists across Canada are pushing for, which is, you know, co-op housing, non-market housing. If you could talk about those sort of issues and your thoughts about them. And I'm asking this because the federal government and the opposition right now in Canada are talking about housing nonstop, but they're not really getting into what real solutions would be often.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think in PEI, much like across the entire country, when you talk about, you know, the high cost of housing, what you always hear in the media, what you always hear from all three levels of government is this supply. It's an issue of supply. They never want to talk about an issue of ownership. You know, I think it was in Ricardo Transgen's book, The Tenant Class, I think it's within the first few pages, it talks about, you know, when vacancy rates actually increase, you also see an increase in rental costs, you know, and that's been, you know, highlighted across the country in many different jurisdictions. So, you know, I think also if you look at OECD data, right, Canada, when you compare it to Ireland, the United States, the United Kingdom, all these places have a similar number of inhabitants per dwelling, same ratio. Yet Canada, you know, the other countries, I think the average price of a home is about 7 times the average wage. Yet in Canada, the average price of a home is about 9 times the average wage, right? So it goes to show that this is not an issue of supply. It's deeper than that. Sure, that might be one part of this equation. Definitely, I'm not going to debate that. But you know, we have to talk more about ownership. Who owns these homes? And the reality is that whenever you have a profit-making scheme, whenever you leave housing to the private market, it's not going to work. Tenants are going to pay the price. I think we engage. I think when you ask about the difference between organizing tenants and pushing for broader things, I think that the two are intrinsically linked, really. You know, a lot of the times that we get people that are involved with the fight for affordable housing, it comes from, you know, that they were served a rent increase above the guideline. They have a hearing at the IRAC, like the tribunal and stuff. And we kind of will work with them, with a group of tenants, to help them kind of fight that rent increase. And then from that, oftentimes people stay involved with the organization. That's where we've had a lot of success. And then, you know, we start talking about this idea of non-market housing, and it's really the only option forward. We have been involved with a couple national calls. There's a conference in Winnipeg, the Social Housing and Human Rights Conference, where we kind of tried to push the government to commit to a certain number of non-market housing options, of new builds, I guess, and constructions over the next like 10 years. And the reality is that in a province like PEI, you know, we have the lowest wages in the country. We have the lowest vacancy rates in the country. Like, we need non-market housing. If you look at our across the board too, I mean, not in PEI, our metrics about on average with Canada, but Canada as a whole, we are significantly below the OECD average of non-market housing options. We know that that's really the only path forward to not just creating affordable housing, but also maintaining affordable options. You know, and then I think you talked a little bit about this idea of kind of tenants and the provincial governments. What we've seen in PEI is this nonstop push. You know, housing is a spectrum. You know, we know that, tenant organizations know that. Yet the only supports we ever really see are people at either end of that spectrum. You know, governments like to support people who are homeless on the far end of the spectrum, which is great. And then they also like to kind of have a lot of programs to push people into home ownership. The reality is that home ownership is not attainable for most tenants, and also a lot of tenants don't want it. They're not interested in that. You know, in PEI, we have a closing cost program. We have a rent to own program, but we don't have, you know, a push for more non-market options for higher rent controls and more strict rent controls, like this rental registry we just spoke of.
One thing that comes to my mind is poverty that's visible and poverty that is less visible. And, you know, the crisis of homelessness is something that is very visible. And, you know, I think it's clear that not enough action is being taken for people without homes. Long-term solutions, structural solutions, this is being made clear. That is poverty on this visual level in communities coast to coast to coast. There's also poverty that's less visible. People are hustling, covering it up, trying to make rent each month, and, you know, are not in the situation, as you described, of buying a home, etc. So I think what's interesting here also is that you've done community organizing work. So can you just talk a bit about how that plays out, the reality of this, that level of poverty in Canada, and how it plays out in terms of maybe some of the cases you've worked on, and also if you have any thoughts about this sort of systemic situation?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's evident whenever you talk to a lot of policymakers, is that, like, they don't understand that life as a tenant is life in precarity, nonstop. That is evidence in a lot of our experiences. You know, one of the big issues currently in PEI, and again, this is an issue of leaving the housing market up to the private market, really. We've seen these big real estate investment trusts enter. And now that, you know, there's a new Residential Tenancy Act that came into effect last year. And I would argue there's some losses for tenants in that. But also there's more strict rent controls baked into it. So now, you know, the maximum rent increase every year can only be 3%, with an additional 3% every year if you apply for rent increase above the guideline. What is happening with that is now that that legislation came out, CAPREIT is basically realizing that it's not as profitable for them to be landlords anymore. So what they've done is they've started doing this conversion into condominiums. So essentially what's happening is these units, these huge multi-unit complexes that, you know, had maybe 60 rental units in them in our city in Charlottetown, are being converted into condominiums and are being sold off. Because under the Residential Tenancy Act, what can happen is if a new buyer buys your home, then they legally can evict you within 2 months. They have to pay you 1 month's rent, but, you know, you're gone out of there in about 2 months. So and then also whether CAPREIT still can be the owner of this, they can charge condo fees, and, you know, they've made a killing selling these. And at the same token, our community, we've lost the stock of rental housing, which is already very low. So why I'm bringing this up to talk a little bit about the precariousness of tenants is that, you know, we found out in dealing with some of these cases that the issue is a lot more broad than we expected. We looked up online through a portal, and we saw that there's actually been applications to convert a number of their units into condominiums. And oftentimes tenants had no idea, because legally under the Condominium Act, Provincial Condominium Act, there's no, basically the landlord does not have to inform tenants that this is happening. So we decided to go door knocking to talk to people. The reality is people were terrified to talk with us. You know, we'd make a couple connections. I mean, PEI is pretty small, so you'd ask around, you'd know, you'd find someone who knew someone who lived in one of these buildings. You know, they'd say, sure, come by this day. But then, you know, the day of, they'd text you, oh, I'm not feeling too well. And then, oh, like, I'm actually not able to make it. And like, they would just keep postponing it. And I don't blame tenants for that, right? Like, we've seen when we've knocked at other doors, we've seen notices saying like, no loitering. If you're letting in guests that you don't know, like, you know, you might have to, basically like letting people know, like to not let strangers in the units. And this was kind of put up in buildings immediately after we started door knocking, you know? So it's hard. It's hard. Not to mention, you know, people don't want to be in the limelight a lot of times. The reality is that, you know, I think, and again, bringing back the tenant class, this is kind of documented that a lot of people think that being a tenant is a phase. And for the people who have that ideology, you know, being a tenant isn't as precarious because maybe they have family or friends to lean back on. The reality is that that's not true for a lot of people. Oftentimes in our inbox, we have messages from tenants saying, you know, I'm getting evicted. I can't make rent. I have nowhere to go. And it breaks our hearts, you know, because we have no funding as an organization. We can tell them to join the list for social housing, which is, you know, prioritizing families and seniors in this province. But the reality is that there's a lot of tenants who are in a difficult spot and need non-market housing options that aren't in a family, that aren't seniors. And it's hard for them. It's hard for them.
The series of situations you were describing, I'm thinking also about sort of steps that happen in somebody's life that leads them towards homelessness, right? And there's a growing reality of homelessness in a lot of communities in Canada, right? And I think the steps and the names of the institutions might be slightly different in Prince Edward Island, but this sort of pattern that you're describing is happening in many places. You know, and I just want to underline what you're saying, that, you know, you've been trying to take on this particular company by speaking to tenants, and it was very clear also that they're responding to your organizing. So, I mean, it also shows the power of organizing in a way. But yeah, can you make that connection between, like, you know, you talked about tenants being precarious, and how does that play out in your community in terms of like people being close to homelessness, and how is that tied to you with the issue of affordable housing? Because often homelessness and, you know, rental issues or like the situation of low income tenants is not immediately connected, you know, and we've come up around that point, like sort of circling around it in working on this housing justice report, because, you know, we spoke to anti-poverty organizations that, you know, maybe haven't been included in, you know, some work around housing justice because the name is different, but there's a connection.
Yeah, I think there's been a couple kind of provincial sessions or municipal sessions that we've been invited to around homelessness. And, you know, I'll make it clear that our organization doesn't work directly with the homeless population, but we definitely see people who are heading down that trajectory. Often. And I think that's why we make it so clear that, you know, and there's been a couple times we haven't been invited, but we make it very clear that we should be there because, you know, we can act as try to help build solutions to stop gap, you know, the increasing this homeless population. And it's because, you know, housing is unaffordable, and we're losing, you know, rental stock. And that's always going to be the case if we don't have non-market options. You know, the Cooper Institute where I work does a lot of work on basic income guarantee, pushing for policies like that, which, you know, are intrinsically linked to tenancy and the affordability issues that tenants face across the country. So, yeah, like I think these two things kind of go hand in hand, and it is terrifying, you know. Speaking with tenants who, like you said, you know, people, there's a lot of this homelessness that seems to be invisible. People living in their cars, people still working full-time jobs, maybe couch surfing, living in their cars. And, you know, that is homelessness. Of course it is. But it's not seen as visible as other forms of homelessness that people are oftentimes more familiar with.
So last question. You've mentioned, Ryan, that you work with Cooper Institute. So for people listening, that's cooperinstitute.ca. You have a lot of different information about the programs that you do there. So encourage people to look that up. You've underlined the importance here of non-market housing options. You're speaking to us from Prince Edward Island. We've heard similar appeals from activists in different cities and community organizers and also researchers that are specialized in this issue. Maybe you could just end by reflecting on why that's important. And also, if you want to share anything about like the people that you've encountered in organizing about how non-market housing option would change their lives.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes we speak with people who are looking for housing options and they just don't exist. Not to mention that there's tons of people who get bought out. PEI comparative to a lot of jurisdictions in Quebec or Ontario or BC, our housing is a lot cheaper. And we saw that during COVID when we had lower restrictions, I should say, in PEI. So what was happening is, there was a huge influx of people moving from out of province to PEI. And the price of housing has went up and the price of rent has went up. I mean, the reality is that a lot of tenants just have no options, and they actually face when their units get bought out, what ends up happening is, they have no place to go. They are getting evicted, but they're getting evicted through illegal means. No eviction is just. But in the legislation, it's very clear that if owner-occupied units, that there can be evictions. And this should protect tenants, right? Having non-market options would be great. We see a big issue we have here on PEI is, and across the country really, but especially because we're a tourist hub, is short-term rentals. A study just came out last week that, 1.3% of PEI's entire housing stock is potential long-term dwellings. Like, they're short-term rentals, but they've actually done the work to see which ones would function as potential long-term dwellings. Our vacancy rate in our whole province is 1.1%. By opening that up, that would more than double the stock of housing for tenants. Not to mention here in Charlottetown, we're at 0.5%. is what our vacancy rate is at. We've tried to kind of appeal to the municipal government to regulate this, and they did, but they walked back on it. They implemented kind of a bylaws to protect and say that only owner occupied short term rentals can really only owner occupied short term rentals can use websites like Airbnb. Yet they've kind of went back on that and said that anybody who had a tourism license prior to the effective date of that bylaw can have their units get legal non conforming use. Right. So they've walked back on that. It's been difficult. Right. We have 18,000 dwellings roughly in Charlottetown. They've already given legal non-conforming status to about, 80 or so, a little over 80. It's significant in a small market like Charlottetown. So non-market housing is really kind of when you leave the housing market up for market forces, it's just not going to work. It's going to continue to increase and increase rents and push tenants for what they got. The last thing I'll leave on, Stefan, is just one thing that we're seeing here in PEI, but I've also been seeing across the country and across the world really, is this rising xenophobia, and this idea that migrants are responsible for the housing crisis. That's very clear. And here in PEI, there's been a big push for a number of postgraduate work permit holders to get access to permanent residency. The government kind of changed the qualifying metrics basically to get access to permanent residency for some of their PMP streams, which has left a lot of these people who have come here to Canada for about 5 years in PEI, and they left them high and dry. Now their postgraduate work permits are expiring after 3 years and they have nowhere to turn to. What we've seen in our community is this idea that, it's this pushback to say that we don't have enough housing here, and migrants are responsible for this increase in immigration. We need to fight against that. We need to recognize that migrants are tenants and we are one unified tenant class. You know, we need to make sure that immigration status is a metric that divides us, right? And it's not migrants that are responsible for this. It's landlords. It's this profiteering in the housing market that is the issue, not you know, other fellow tenants who are here experiencing the same hardships that all tenants are.
Ryan, thanks so much for the conversation today.
Yeah, appreciate it, Stefan. Take care.
That was a conversation with Ryan McRae of the Cooper Institute in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, speaking about how the housing crisis is affecting his community in Charlottetown, a reality that is taking place from coast to coast to coast. This series takes place in the context of organizing and planning towards a gathering for housing justice at Concordia University from March 7th to 9th, 2024. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. I host and produce the show. Thanks so much to the Social Justice Center for supporting this project. Free City Radio airs on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Geogeagi, Montreal on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC, on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. We are also podcasts. Look us up through your podcast platforms. Just search Free City Radio. Our archives are at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I will be back next week. Take care.
Calling all SGPS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is going to referendum this year to seek continuance of its optional student fee. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more.